questions.
Sir.
How did I find my guru when I went to India? See, this is another generation now. What do I do now? There's a book called Be Here Now. That after all these years is still selling, and it describes in vivid detail how I did that. So I'll pass it up tonight because 90% of these people have heard it ad nauseum. The reason. All I know, it was grace. I didn't find him, he found me. That sounds arrogant, but I mean, he brought me to him. I feel that. I feel his grace. Incredible grace. I wasn't even expecting to meet anybody like that. Have I any advice for the Bhagwan of Oregon? Late of Oregon. I've never met him, and I find it very painful to watch the whole drama unfold, because I think that each time a spiritual statement gets fraught with paranoia and with anger and with divisiveness and all that, it really hurts all of us. Just hurts all of us. It hurts all of our faith. And I think that Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh has said some beautiful things and things that have offended me. He said he has many powers, obviously. He has a lot of siddhis. And I think that many people that come over from the East often are very vulnerable to our value systems. And it's easy to get holy in certain conditions and hard to keep it. It's hard to keep your high in New York City, you know, because there's a lot of desire stuff around. And I think that we're just realizing that you don't end up becoming, as I've said before, a connoisseur of clay feet. You take what you can take from each teacher, and then if they end up with their impurities, that's their problem. You don't spend your time being bitter or judging or anything. There's no sense in doing that at all. And don't demand that everybody be perfect. Just take what you can. There were some beautiful teachings that came out of Rajneesh and may come again. There's also his life is a teaching. Each of us in our hearts will know what message we get from it. I think the game is much more subtle than the one we've been thinking it is, where some perfectly wise person says just the way it is all the time. I think the whole thing is the teaching. And I've been getting a tremendous teaching out of Rajneesh. You know, each Rolls Royce, I just want one of them. I mean, I got to get in my Volvo every day and think of him with 90 Rolls Royces. And, oh, God. Why aren't I pure enough to have 90 Rolls Royces? One of my thoughts about Adam, or also known as XTC. It's a chemical that has been used very widely. It's just been outlawed by the DEA. It's been used widely in therapy and in relationships, and those of you that have used it know that it is quite extraordinary in the way in which it allows people to see through the veils and to see the preciousness of their partner. And it takes a lot of relationships that are very locked in habitual closeness to each other and opens them up again. And I'm sorry it's been outlawed. I really am, because I think it has been useful. But I will say, and I'm really certainly, I honor my drug experiences, and I've taken Adam many times and found it very beautiful. At the same moment, it's just beginning to dawn on me that I am constantly grabbing at a drug in order to make this moment different. And it's just getting to the point now where I'm ready to say that my liberation is going to be in this moment as it is. And I'm not quite trying to keep remolding it all the time. And I saw an interesting thing. I saw that I saw that this summer in meditation, that with drugs, there was a way in which the drug was constantly reinforcing a feeling that I wasn't enough the way I am. But me plus the drug would be something else. And that I needed it to break through places in myself. And then I met my guru, and I felt that I wasn't enough, but me plus my guru was enough. And that in a way, I was totally dependent on his grace, or I was totally dependent on the drugs. And when I was meditating, and always when they would take things, like in the Buddhist litany of the Eightfold Noble Path, there's a thing called right effort, and I always protested about that. And I always protested about the idea that I had any personal responsibility. I always say, I remember with Trungpa Rinpoche once, when he said, Ram Dass, we have to accept responsibility. I said, what responsibility? God has all the responsibility. I don't have any. Not my, but thy will, O Lord. And he said, you're copping out. And this summer when I was meditating, I'll tell you the story because it's interesting. I snuck in, secretly, a picture of my guru. See, that's a no-no in a Buddhist meditation center. You're supposed to just follow your breath. And I had it in my room, and every day I would allow myself a fix, you know. I'd look at him and say, I love you so much, and how do you think we can get through this together? And what happened was after about 2 weeks of meditation, this is a bizarre story, suddenly, one morning I woke up and I was starting to follow my breath rising and falling, and into my mind came the chant, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram, Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Now, I sang that chant from 1967, well, continuously for 10, 15 years. It's a method. And now, I couldn't stop the chant. And all the cows and the cars and everything all came out as Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. Everything sounded like the chant. And I kept thinking, I'll follow my breath, rising, falling. And the Shri Ram, Jai Ram, rising, Shri Ram, Jai. And it wouldn't stop. And I started to climb the walls. And I thought, well, at least, the thing that's the major obstacle to this method is another holy method. I mean, that's not bad. I mean, I could be full with lust, but instead I'm just filled with holy songs. I'm just caught between two methods. For 2 weeks, this went on. Finally, I copped to it, and I went to my teacher, and I said, I've got this problem. My mind keeps creating this stuff. I know it's in my mind. I can't get rid of it. I'm trying not to get rid of it, but to live with it. I'm doing everything you tell me to do. What do I do? He says, oh, you must have studied in India. I said, yes. He said, were you a bhakti? I said, yes. And he sort of laughed. He says, well, he said, take refuge in the Buddha and you'll get rid of it. And I thought, my God, I'm going to use the Buddha to get rid of Ram. I mean, Ram is God and the Buddha, somehow, this is insane, you know. So I went back to my abode and I thought, well, look, it's fair. You do one method at a time. How many methods are you going to do at once? And if each method leads to truth, I shouldn't need to hold on to one method. Any method will bring me to the same place. So I took my guru's picture and I said, well, Maharaji, for 18 years I haven't eaten a piece of food without offering it to you. I've just been thinking about you. You've been my method. I'm putting you away. Because you're truth and this method will bring me to truth. And then I'll know you in a new way. Well, I put him away, and when I came to eating, I'd say, may this food bring me strength in order to pursue truth. See, instead of I offer it to, you know, I stopped offering him, he could starve to death. It didn't matter to me. I was going to do this thing. This coldness crept over me. I mean, it was very strange, and I just kept doing it, very cool. And the meditation went on. And immediately that I did that, put the picture away, the chant stopped, by the way. Far out, right? Now, I came back from the meditation, came back to the country, and my whole relation to my guru was changed. It wasn't this kind of slushy, devotional, you know, you there, I'm there, hi, you know, it wasn't the picture guy anymore. It was much more like, that kind of thing. It was like being with a rock, or a very solid thing. And I started to wonder where that bhakti went, where that kind of really soft emotional place went, because I saw other bhakti people and I was kind of jealous of them. Sorry for this long story, but it's... Now, here's really where it got really hot. We had the first operation for my stepmother, and then there was a spot in her liver, and we weren't sure what that represented, because the first thing had been in her thigh, and whether it had metastasized through her liver, in which case it would be systemic. So they did a needle biopsy, and then they were going to call us on Tuesday, and she and I are doing this whole thing together. I mean, we visit the doctor together, we hang in together, we hold each other, we've become very close through. We've known each other now in a way we never knew each other before she got sick. I mean, it's just incredible, the love between us. And she's an incredibly great woman. So the telephone call came on Tuesday noon, and I was in my room, and I happened to be on the floor reading and sitting there, and I looked up, and there was a picture of Maharaji on the wall. And here I've written a book called Miracle of Love, which some of you know, which is about 1,000 stories about Maharaji, many of which are miracle stories, in which he heals the blind and cures the lame and does all that stuff. See? So I look at the picture and the phone rings and the nurse says, just a minute for the doctor. And I say to Maharaji, look, I'm not going to ask you for anything because you know it's got to be the way it's got to be, and I know that too. So I can't really ask for anything in my prayers. But if it doesn't make any difference to you and you can, a little something, I wouldn't mind, you know. If suddenly they say, oh, you know. The doctor comes on the phone and he says, Mrs. Alpert, I'm terribly sorry to have to tell you that it has metastasized to your liver. It's the worst kind of cell, very fast growing, and if we don't have it out right away, you'll be dead within a month. And I felt my heart grab like that. And I looked at the picture and I found myself involuntarily saying, you son of a bitch. And it absolutely blew my mind. And the next thought was, but we're still here, aren't we? And I realized at that moment that I had met him as Shiva. I had met him in the next level of our being together. That up until then, it had been relatively soft the way I knew the spirit. And now I was meeting that part that was involved with chaos and destruction and all of that. And I felt closer. But the closeness wasn't this kind of lush, soft closeness. It was just the closeness of, yeah, we're both here. And what I feel now is, in completion of that question, is that I am accepting the fact that I have responsibility and that I am working on myself. And I'm not asking him. I am living in grace with all of it, all of its grace, all of its grace. But it's not mushy anymore. It's very hard and clear and harsh and soft. But, well, the answer is there's no reason to do anything, but what are you going to do? See, you can't not do something. And what you end up doing is wanting to keep opening yourself to be more an instrument of the harmony or the way of things. And you're constantly listening to hear, you're constantly doing it automatically, listening to hear how you fit into the play of it all, what parts you play. And the more conscious you become and the more that compassionate heart opens, the more you are an instrument of the relief of suffering just by your being. The more you just keep creating an environment for other people to awaken, if they want to awaken. You don't lay a trip, you don't force anybody, because there's nothing to do. You just are the statement of that compassionate consciousness. It's very far out. There's very little to do. So you can do it full time. Let us just end now, before you go, let us end with Jubilate, because it's just so nice. Now, this is a 6-part round, and you've got to be good or you'll screw up completely, all right? So, I got to knock you into shape very quickly.
Jubilate Deo, Jubilate Deo, Alleluia.
Again. Jubilate Deo, jubilate Deo. Alleluia, alleluia. Okay, now it's going to be crisper and cleaner, right? And sharper and a little faster, like we're awake. Jubilate Deo, jubilate Deo. Alleluia, alleluia. Once more without me.